From Columbia Radio News, this is Battleground 2006, continuing live coverage of the midterm elections from the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. I'm Brett Elliott.
And I'm Alexa Danner. This hour, we'll be hearing from our correspondents at the Democratic and Republican National Headquarters in Washington and take a look at the races in the New York area.
The race for New York Attorney General has been shaken by criminal allegations.
He hasn't proven nothing to me.
I mean, we're right back to the same thing. Where's the jobs?
Even though incumbent Senator Hillary Clinton is a firm favorite, some upstate New Yorkers are not on the bandwagon.
There is a candidate who is being accused of criminal wrongdoing and is under investigation by a number of law enforcement agencies. That's not me, however.
We'll hear live updates from Tennessee and Missouri as we continue our coverage of the 2006 midterm elections after these headlines.
This is Columbia Radio News. I'm Gretchen Kuda, and this is the news at the top of the hour. Of the closely watched races tonight, several networks project that when all the votes are counted, Rick Santorum will lose to Bob Casey in Pennsylvania. And in New Jersey, it appears that it's possible Democratic candidate Bob Menendez will have defeated Republican Tom Kean Jr. In Acapulco, Mexico, two grenades exploded at a residential building that is believed to be home to several local police officers. The explosions occurred just hours before President Vicente Fox and President-elect Felipe Calderon arrived in the area to participate in a business forum. The violence occurred after several homemade bombs exploded in Mexico City, damaging the top electoral court, a bank, and the former ruling party's headquarters. No one was injured. The results of Nicaragua's presidential elections are in. Daniel Ortega, a former Marxist revolutionary who fought off a U.S.-backed insurgency in the 1980s, beat out Harvard-educated Eduardo Montealegre by 13%. Ortega formerly held the presidential post, but lost it in 1990, ending Sandinista rule and years of civil war. After 16 years, he has won the presidency back. Voters who are having problems at the polls today are in good company. Chelsea Clinton, the daughter of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and former President Bill Clinton, was apparently turned away from a Manhattan polling place today because her name did not appear in the voter roll books. Investigators determined that her name had been sent to the wrong polling location. She wasn't able to vote at the polls, but Ms. Clinton will receive a provisional ballot instead. Record rainfall is flooding parts of the Pacific Northwest. One person is confirmed dead, and homes in Washington and Oregon have been evacuated. Governors of both states declared emergencies in several counties and have called for assistance from the National Guard. Voters in several Washington counties may have trouble making it to the polls because of the floodwaters. Fortunately, nearly all Washington counties now vote by mail. The United Nations named American diplomat Josette Sheeran head of the World Food Program. Sheeran, currently the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economics, Business, and Cultural Affairs, said her top priorities will be to ensure no child goes to bed hungry and to reduce hunger-related deaths. The World Food Program was founded in 1962 and provides aid for an average of 90 million people, including 58 million children across the world. Dutch police arrested five men and a woman suspected of recruiting radical Muslims for terrorist activities. According to a statement by the National Public Prosecutor's Office, the six suspects were arrested today following a year-long investigation. Dutch Secret Service began tracking the suspects after they had indicated an interest in fighting for Islamic extremists. And finally, Boeing scored a victory in the airline wars today when FedEx canceled its order for a number of Airbus Super Jumbo jets. The company said instead it will buy Boeing 777s. FedEx said delays in the Airbus A380 Super Jumbo jet are the reason for canceling the 10 Airbus planes. Gretchen Kuda, Columbia Radio News.
Report.
reporter Lisa Desai of Columbia Radio News is at the headquarters of Democratic candidate Bob Menendez in East Brunswick, New Jersey. We go to her now. Hello.
Hi. I'm standing here right now just outside of Menendez headquarters, and they're just getting ready to call the race. We're hearing right now that CNBC has called this race for Menendez, but we haven't had confirmation yet from the Menendez team. The race has been very tight. It's been neck and neck from day one. It's been a dirty race as well, lots of allegations of corruption. Today the Kane camp was also alleging that Menendez campaigners vandalized their headquarters. So the vicious race has really come to the very last day.
And how well has Menendez overcome the Kane allegations of corruption, do you think?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. It's really loud in the background here.
Lisa, I'm asking you about the allegations of corruption by the Kane campaign and how it's affected Menendez.
Well, the one thing that I've noticed about voters here in New Jersey is while corruption is an important issue to them, many of the voters are more concerned about Iraq and are more concerned about Kane's position and potential siding with Bush. Bob Menendez has done a really good job of trying to paint Senator Tom Kane Jr. as a Bush backer. And I think that's why Menendez has really been had a steady but small lead in this race.
And what have the major issues been throughout the race?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
What have the major issues been in this race?
Some of the major issues here have been basically around corruption. New Jersey's long had to battle corruption. And, of course, Iraq is a big issue. As I said, a lot of people here are really worried about the troops still being there and really just want to see the troops get pulled out. And they're just ready to move on and not be part of the war anymore.
And Clinton and Barack Obama campaigned with Menendez on Sunday. How do you think that helped his chances? Did it give him a last-minute boost?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. There's just a lot of noise back here. I think people are really excited. And
we were just asking how the Clinton and Barack Obama campaigning on Sunday helped Menendez.
Well, Kane has been really trying to paint Menendez to be a really corrupt senator, part of a long list of Hudson County politicians who are not working for his people, but working to line his own pockets. And I think corruption has really been a big deal in McCain campaign. He's been alleging that Mr. Menendez is under federal investigation.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Lisa Desai is a reporter for Columbia Radio News in New Jersey.
We're watching some close Senate races across the country tonight. We've heard the Democrats have already picked up a Senate seat in Pennsylvania. Another seat they hope to win is in Tennessee. It's been 16 years since a Democrat came close to winning a Senate seat there. Maybe that's why this race has become so contentious and nasty. Gabrielle Warman of Columbia Radio News reports.
Democratic Congressman Harold Ford Jr. was neck and neck with former Chattanooga Mayor Bob Corker when Republicans unleashed this year's most controversial and negative campaign ad. Ford is African American. The ad featured an attractive white woman wearing an off-the-shoulder dress.
I met Harold at the Playboy party.
The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Harold, call me.
Ford was quick to condemn the ad and his opponent.
The campaign has come up short on ideas, short on integrity with these new ads, and short on vision.
Ford's vision is relatively conservative for a Democrat. He's for prayer in school, he's tough on immigration, and against gay marriage.
I've never supported gay marriage. It's unconscionable to think of giving schoolgirls abortion pills. But again, this election's about change.
This election is critical to the Democrats, who have flooded the state with money and support, as Bob Corker frequently points out.
I realize that simultaneously, Congressman Ford received a check for $900,000. And it's evident that my opponent and the Ford political machine has sold out now to these northeastern liberals. So obviously my opponent is desperate.
Corker has run on a platform of supporting the troops in Iraq and lowering the cost of health care. He has also benefited from the support of his party. It is estimated he spent over $14 million on this race, compared to Ford's $10 million. A month ago, it looked as if Ford might be the first African-American to be elected from the South since Reconstruction. But the latest polls show Corker slightly in the lead. Whoever wins, the outcome may well determine which party controls the Senate. Gabrielle Warman, Columbia Radio News.
The Tennessee Senate race is one of the most crucial for the Democrats. My colleague Carrie Ederer talked with Christian Gross, an assistant professor of political science at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, about the possibility of an African-American senator there.
I think if Ford wins, it's historic because he's the first African-American to represent the South in the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction. That's historically significant if that happens.
Do you think that race will be a deciding factor at the polls in Tennessee tonight?
I think that race is a factor. I think the deciding factor, based on the way things are shaping up, is George Bush and his popularity. Even in Tennessee, Bush's disapproval is just slightly above 50%, and his approval is only in the 40s. I think that could potentially hurt the Republicans. I also think this race is very much about Ford versus Corker, Ford being black and Corker being white. I think the state is Republican. Corker is a Republican. That gives him an edge. Now, Ford being African-American, that does hurt him. But I also think that there's a lot of other factors that are at play, and this race is actually pretty tough to predict.
What are some of the other factors at play between the two candidates?
The negativity of the campaign and the ad that had an implicit racial appeal, according to many, combined with a number of other negative ads, have really hurt Ford. And things were leaning towards Corker, I would say, as of the last couple of days. The turnout here is really high in traditionally Democratic precincts and high African-American precincts. I don't know if that's good news for Ford in the sense of he will win, but the turnout levels are actually much higher than they're approaching presidential level turnout in some of the Democratic precincts. And some of the Republican precincts are high, but not at the same level of turnout.
So you think the overall turnout could benefit the Democrats?
Oh, yeah. I mean, higher turnout, especially if it's in the Democratic areas are Memphis, Nashville, and then to a lesser extent some other urban areas in the state. And within Nashville and within Memphis, it seems like the turnout is relatively high compared to some of the other parts of the state that are more Republican.
And along with the ads, as we were talking about before, there seems to have been a lot of name-calling during this campaign. Do you think this has had an impact on voters?
The tone of the ads has been extremely negative, and also extremely negative on personal attacks more than on issues. And I think voters really get turned off by personal attacks.
Christian Gross, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
That was Christian Gross, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University, with my colleague Carrie Ederer.
Andy Scher of Columbia Radio News is at the Democratic National Committee's headquarters in Washington, D.C. He joins us by phone to give us the latest. Andy, do we have you there? Do we have Andy on the line? I guess we seem to be having a couple technical difficulties. Pitfalls of live radio, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, we're going to Kate McCarthy of Columbia Radio News. She's at the Republican National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C. She's joining us by phone. Hello, Kate. Are you there? Hello, Kate. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes.
Hi, Kate.
Sorry, Alexa, you just cut out. Hi.
What's it like over at the Republican Senatorial Committee headquarters?
It's been pretty quiet here today so far, as everyone's been waiting for these returns to come in. There's only been a handful of reporters here. They've been coming in and out all evening. We're set up in the lobby of the Republican Senatorial Committee headquarters. But overall, it's been pretty quiet.
Well, we were going to speak with Andrew Scher over at the Democratic headquarters, but we were unable to get him. Do you anticipate any difference in climate between the two headquarters at this point?
We saw the Democratic headquarters on television briefly. It seemed that theirs had been a little bit louder, perhaps. However, Senator Dole was just asked about that question, about the difference between the Republican and the Democratic headquarters, and she said that that there's plenty of time for big events and that the Republicans are focused on what's at hand and going about their business.
So what is at stake for the Republicans in the Senate this election?
Well, the Republicans have a 5-seat majority in the Senate right now, and they're defending 15 seats this election. Of those 15, they need 10 in order to maintain the majority. That would put them at even 50-50, with Vice President Cheney casting the deciding vote. They've had control over the past 4 years. There are a few states that people are paying attention to, but mainly Montana, Missouri, and Virginia are the three that the analysts have in the toss-up category, and Republicans are defending those.
And the Republicans in the House have been in the majority since 1994. What's at stake for them?
That's right. The Republicans have held the majority in the House much longer than they have in the Senate. They're currently defending 230 seats. In order to get a majority, they need 218 to win. Right now, what's at stake right now is, among other things, but also the 20 House committee chairmanships, over 20 House committee chairmanships that could change hands.
We've started to see some exit poll data come through. What have you heard?
ABC News was reporting that early exit poll data said 6 out of 10 Americans disapprove of the way Bush has handled his job. But earlier tonight, the Republicans actually handed the reporters a press release here, cautioning us to not listen to early exit poll data. According to that release, they said that, quote, exit polls traditionally have a Democrat bias. So they'd prefer for us to not listen to those early reports.
Well, thank you, Kate. That was our reporter, Kate McCarthy, at the Republican National Committee headquarters in Washington, D.C.
And I am told we do now have Andy Scherr on the line again. He is at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Brett.
Excellent. So have there been any announcement there at the headquarters about the New Jersey Senate race yet?
Yes, absolutely, Brett. Bob Menendez won about an hour ago, and cheers erupted. And there have been multiple announcements since then. They've been rolling in by the minute, it seems. And every time one comes in, Democrat, place goes wild, Brett.
Great. Do party officials there see this as a sign of how other races might go over the course of the evening?
I think that party officials really are just sort of caught up in the ambiance of this place. And, you know, I've talked to a few of them, and anything anybody said has been positive. So I think that they were pretty much feeling confident from the get-go, and that hasn't changed much, especially since Democrats seem to be claiming seats left and right.
Do they regard the New Jersey Senate race as a particularly important race?
Well, judging from the cheers that erupted, wild cheers that erupted when Menendez won, I assume so. But that was positive to be one of the tight races in this election. So I believe that the results are, people are very happy with those results here.
Great, Andy. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
One of our in-house analysts tonight, Justin Phillips, is with us here in the studio. He is a professor of American politics at Columbia University. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, good to have you here. So I realize it's early, but are you aware of any surprises in the election results so far?
Well, so far things seem to be going as expected. The Democrats won in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Jersey, and I think that's what most experts would have predicted at the beginning of the evening, and that's what public opinion polls had shown. We still have to wait. It's still early on many of the really key House races at this point, but the Democrats seem like they're going to be picking up a number of seats, some in Ohio, some in Indiana, maybe a seat in Kentucky.
Great. Now, what, if anything, do you read into the Menendez victory or the announced Menendez victory?
Well, I think that this was a seat that the Democrats absolutely had to retain if they hope to win the majority in the U.S. Senate. Everyone thought the Democrats would probably hold this seat, although the polls had grown much closer in recent weeks. But again, they had to hold the seat, and it looks like they have. And I think what we're really looking forward to see now is sort of the Virginia results roll in, the Tennessee results, the Missouri results, and the Montana results.
Do you think that the Democrats will take a lot of heart from this victory of Menendez?
I think they will, but again, I think it was an anticipated victory, so it won't mean as much to them as if they were to win Virginia, for instance, or Tennessee.
All right. And again, what are the races that you're looking forward to next?
Really looking forward to the Virginia results, see what happens as precincts from Northern Virginia report.
Excellent. Now,
Thank you very much, Justin. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to Yasmin Qureshi, Columbia radio news reporter in Connecticut, where she's reporting on the Senate race. Yasmin, are you there? Do I have Yasmin?
Here.
Hi, Yasmin. How are things going there?
Well, it's kind of a downer mood here. It looks like Lamont has lost by about 10%, and I think people here thought it was going to be a little bit closer, so the mood's kind of a little bit it's sad, but nonetheless expected.
So what impact do you think that this result will have on the Senate?
It's really hard to say at this point. You know, a lot of people think that Lieberman will go back to the Democratic caucus, but it's hard to say. It's very possible that he may side with Republicans on key issues like the war in Iraq, as he has in the past. It's very hard to say. It depends on what happens with other races. But it could have some impact on the way things play out.
Lieberman was showing a double-digit lead over Lamont in recent weeks. What changed since the primary?
I think that experts that I've spoken with, said that after the primary, Lamont started to focus on domestic issues, which really didn't differentiate him that much from Lieberman, and he sort of went away from his anti-Iraq war message for a long time, and then in the last week or so, he revisited it. But I think that hurt him in the long run. It's hard to say. Also, you know, Lieberman is a really well-known household name. I think there were a lot of Democrats who wanted to support Lieberman. I think there was some divide in that party support towards Lieberman.
And how has Lieberman's alliance with Republicans hurt him or helped him in recent weeks?
Well, I think it hurt him in the sense that the initial campaign against Lieberman were Democrats who were really upset that he had aligned himself with the Republicans. I think largely the Democrats that supported him are ones who, felt that he was more in line with them on domestic issues. They trusted him more. They didn't know who Ned Lamont was. And so I think it did hurt him to a certain extent, but I think in the end he pulled through because of his strengths and how well-known he is to people in America.
Do you think this race will have repercussions in the House races around Connecticut?
Well, I think that Ned Lamont's movement was important for some of the House races because it really brought the anti-war platform out and was very important and is very important in a lot of the House races in Connecticut. And what's significant about that is that there's a lot of moderate Republicans that stand the chance of losing their seat. So Ned Lamont really was, pivotal in bringing the anti-war platform to a head in Connecticut.
Well, thank you very much, Yasmin.
No problem, Alexa.
That was Yasmin Qureshi in Connecticut at the Lamont headquarters.
When you talk to me, In Connecticut, the Senate race, which is now being called for Lieberman, is generating national headlines. But a House race may be a better indicator of the voters' mood in this election. The race pits Republican incumbent Christopher Shays, a 19-year veteran of the House, against Democratic challenger Diane Farrell. Matt Grant of Columbia Radio News reports from Connecticut.
This race is a rematch from 2 years ago when Shays ran against Farrell and won 52% to 48%. This time, polls show the race is a dead heat. Shays is in the fight of his political life for one reason, the Iraq War and his support for it, according to his campaign manager, Michael Sohn.
People have told us time and time again, don't discuss the war in Iraq. Don't talk about it. Run away from it. Hide from it. Don't discuss it. Chris is not the type of person to do that. He took it head on. He went to Iraq 14 times. He went there to see exactly what was going on. And so was he going to go commit to 14 trips and then come back to his district and hide and not talk about the war? No way.
Shays is a moderate Republican and strongly backed the war. But he also said Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld should resign. Where he's taken heat is from his shifting views, opposing a timetable for troop withdrawal, for instance, and then arguing that a timetable was necessary. Challenger Diane Farrell says she's voted for Shays in the past, but she's blasted his stance on the war.
For 3.5 years, Chris Shays has been wrong on Iraq. He's been one of George Bush's strongest supporters and has given him a blank check to run an open-ended war. We've lost over 2,600 troops and spent over $300 billion. While families here struggle to pay for gas, college tuition, and health care.
Shays' campaign manager, Michael Sohn, says tactics like that polarize voters along partisan lines.
We have great support across party lines. And, you know, and it's who Chris is and it's what Chris is about. Chris doesn't feed into the anger and the hate that sort of is under the surface of in this country that our opponent loves to feed off of and where she gets her support from because she's feeding into people's fears and anger.
At the Southport Brewing Company, a popular restaurant and bar in Fairfield, many of the customers discussed politics and the war on the night before the election. And some of those conversations got a little heated, like this one between a bartender and a waitress.
I don't know. I've never supported the war. I 100% believe in our troops. I believe I want to get them all home safe and that they're over there doing what they believe, but I don't necessarily support the reasons that we went to war in the first place. I'll be right back.
Buy them cookies and say sorry, shit happens.
I didn't say that, did I?
Here, the night before the election, most people were still undecided. In this district, 42% of registered voters identify themselves as unaffiliated. These are the voters that the Shays campaign needs to pick up in order to win. Alice Molina is one of those undecided independents. She's not sure she'll vote for Shays because of his stance on the war.
Well, I think Shay has been around for a long time. He's very well respected, but we're not really happy at the direction he's going with the government right now. There's things that he's supporting that I think many of us who are independent are not supporting. For his opponent, I don't think we know much about her.
Doug Prescott, a retired Democrat in his 60s, says he plans to vote for Farrell.
She's a Democrat. I have no interest in either. Both parties are totally corrupt. The whole system is totally corrupt. But I like my crooks better than their crooks. So that's why I'm voting for Diane Farrell. I have no love for her.
63-year-old teacher John Hoover says he'll vote for Farrell because of her stance on the war.
I'm voting more against Shays' record, particularly on the war. He's made numerous trips to Iraq. And as far as I'm concerned, he's too close to the Republican party line of disillusionment and deceit on the war, and has not been realistic about it.
And some voters, like Andrew Shaw, are disgusted with both candidates.
All the candidates have completely turned me off. The comments are all the same, anti-this, anti-that. This one's on this side, this one's on that side. And the biggest complaint this year has been the constant mailers in my mailbox, 5 or 10 pieces a day, every day of the week. And as of today, the day before the election, I think I probably received 8 to 10 phone calls reminding me to vote for each and every one of the candidates.
A few blocks up the road at one of Shays' campaign offices, a group of volunteers is making phone calls reminding registered Republicans and independents to vote.
Good evening, ma'am. My name is John. I'm with the Chris Shays campaign. How are you tonight?
The Republican National Committee recruited volunteers from across the country. Here in Fairfield, only 4 out of the 28 are actually Connecticut residents. In an effort to make a difference in this tight race, they spent this past weekend knocking on 10,000 doors and making 20,000 phone calls. Matt Grant, Columbia Radio News.
Let's turn again to Justin Phillips, a political science professor here at Columbia University. He's one of our in-house election experts. Justin, tell us a little bit about the Lieberman victory and what it signifies for national races.
Well, I'm not sure that we can read too much into the Lieberman victory. I think ultimately he beat Lamont because he was a more polished politician. He's held elected office since he was 28 years old. Voters in Connecticut are very familiar with him. And I think that Lamont didn't do particularly well in his campaign to try and reach out to moderate independents or moderate to liberal Republicans. And these voters ended up going for Lieberman, and Lamont was left primarily with liberal and anti-war Democrats.
And if there's a tie in the Senate and Lieberman is an independent, what are the implications of that?
Well, I think that should there be a tie in the Senate, or should the Democrats have a one-seat majority, the Republicans are probably going to try and do everything within their power to convince Lieberman to switch to the Republican caucus. They'll probably offer him various committee chairmanships and do whatever they need to. And we can certainly anticipate that, although I think Lieberman will probably remain with the Democratic Party. He's been a Democrat throughout his political career. Most of his voting record tends to vote like most Democrats in the Senate. And he's looked like a Republican on the war and on fighting terrorism, but on most issues he votes like a very good, solid Democrat to liberal Democrat.
Does Lieberman's victory mean that the country is not as strongly anti-Iraq as we anticipated?
Well, I'd be careful again about reading too much into this campaign, but I do think that some of the preliminary exit polls have shown that voters are also concerned about issues of corruption and concerned about the economy. And so while Iraq war is key on many voters' mind, there are a number of other issues. And in the Lieberman case, again, I think voters were particularly familiar with him, and doesn't seem like sort of the anti-war issue or the voters' sort of sentiments on Iraq was enough to push Lamont across the finish line to victory.
Why do you think there was such a stark difference between the primaries, where Lamont had such a strong lead, and tonight, where he lost so significantly?
Well, if you remember, the primary was still relatively close. Lamont only won by a few points, a few percentage points. And the Connecticut case in this primary was much like other primaries in that the voters who participated tend to be party activists. Voters in the primary tended to be more liberal, more anti-war Democrats. And so when we go to the general election, that electorate is broadened. And Lamont just, again, wasn't very successful at appealing to that wider electorate, to moderate voters and independents and liberal Republicans.
With a look ahead to 2008, what are the implications of a Senate or House majority for the Democrats or both?
Well, a number of experts, and I tend to agree with this, suggest that it may actually hurt the Democrats' chances in 2008 to have Congress controlled by the Republicans or to have the House controlled by the Democrats, because it gives Republicans something to run against. And if the Democrats don't have the House or Senate, their nominee in 2008 can then not only run against the Bush legacy, but can also run against the Republican Congress.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Justin. You're
And now an update from Tennessee and Missouri, where polls closed at 8. In the Tennessee Senate race, Republican Bob Corker is leading Democrat Harold Ford by 13 points, with just over 4% of precincts reporting. In the race for the House, Democrats could take 4 of Tennessee's 9 seats. Republicans look like they'll hold another 4. No precincts are reporting yet what's happening with the last seat.
The Missouri Senate race has been neck and neck for weeks. Republican incumbent James Talent said this morning he was hopeful he could fend off a challenge by Democrat Claire McCaskill.
I do sense a real good intensity level out there on our side, so I think we're going to hold our own, but, you know, you never know. That's why this is an art, not a science.
But the race is still too close to call. With precincts reporting less than a point difference between the two candidates, it could be hours before results are final. And this just in. In Connecticut, it looks like Senator Joe Lieberman running as an independent has beat out Democratic candidate Ned Lamont. Lamont won the Democratic primary in August on a strong anti-war message over the three-term incumbent Lieberman. Lamont's numbers have been slipping in the polls ever since.
The race to succeed New York's high-profile Attorney General Eliot Spitzer is not close, but it has been heated. Columbia Radio News reporter Betty Yu gives us an overview.
Republican candidate and former Westchester District Attorney Jeanine Pirro has had a very bad year. First, she pulled out of a Senate run against Senator Hillary Clinton. Then, after deciding to run for Attorney General, she was overheard on a federal wiretap. She was discussing the possibility of bugging her husband's boat to see if he was cheating on her. The incident was a boon for Democratic candidate Andrew Cuomo.
There is a candidate who is being accused of criminal wrongdoing and is under investigation by a number of law enforcement agencies and has their ethics questioned. That's not me, however.
You know, Andrew, your running for Attorney General would be like my running for Joe Torre's position because I played softball 21 years ago.
Pirro has tried to divert attention from the scandal by emphasizing her experience as a DA, prosecuting sex crimes and Medicaid fraud. In a series of TV ads, she has attacked Cuomo for being unqualified to lead the state's largest law firm.
Jeanine Pirro, 30 years fighting crime. Prosecutor, judge, district attorney. Andrew Cuomo, 14 months as a junior prosecutor. 21 years ago, little courtroom experience.
Pirro's campaign has been distracted by other scandals surrounding her husband, Albert Pirro. He's a millionaire lobbyist who has served time in prison for tax fraud. Andrew Cuomo, son of former New York Governor Mario Cuomo, is no stranger to bad press. A secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, he ran an unsuccessful campaign for governor in 2002. This year, he's benefiting from the support of popular gubernatorial candidate Eliot Spitzer.
When Andrew Cuomo turned around the troubled agency under Bill Clinton, he was in charge of 300 lawyers who took on very powerful interests, demonstrating the kind of fearlessness that got him confirmed twice by the U.S. Senate, by both parties. He rooted out corruption, stopped the bad guys, fought everything from bigotry to gun violence.
New York Daily News columnist William Hammond says whoever wins on Tuesday will have big shoes to fill.
As I approach my decision, I try to think of the awesome power that the office has. I think it always had this power, it's just that no one realized it until Eliot Spitzer figured out how to make maximum use of its power. Just the publicity alone can be enough to force change. The very announcement that Eliot Spitzer was suing a company was enough to cause the stock price to plunge.
Hammond says the recent campaign scandal involving state comptroller Alan Hevesy has overshadowed the Pirro scandal. Hevesy used state funds to pay for his wife's chauffeur. But Pirro is now 20 percentage points behind Cuomo in most public opinion polls. Hammond speculates that after this race, Jeanine Pirro may return to the law profession or become a television commentator or talk show host. Betty Yu, Columbia Radio News.
Joining us again in the studio is Justin Phillips, one of our in-house expert and a Columbia professor in political science. Hello again, Justin.
Thank you.
So, Justin, talk to us a little bit about the Hevesy race and the scandal that has plagued that particular contest.
Well, I think the scandal has certainly attracted a lot of attention in recent days and has certainly hurt Hevesy's poll numbers, although it's unclear if it's going to cause him to lose the race. In large part because the Democrats have such a large margin of victory in New York and the other races, and in Eliot Spitzer's race and in Hillary Clinton's race, that while Hevesy is damaged by the recent scandals, I'm unsure if it's actually going to cost him the race.
I spoke to New York Times correspondent Adam Nagorny yesterday, and he said every year it's a bit of a cliche. They tend to write that each year the campaigns get dirtier and dirtier and then the net adds more and more negative. But even he said this year he thinks it's actually a little bit true. What's your impression of that?
I agree. I think that the ads have been particularly negative this year, especially from the Republican side. We've seen a lot of negative advertisement in New York, in fact, in some of the upstate congressional races. We've seen negative advertisement in Virginia and obviously in Tennessee with the famous Bob Corker ad. And I think that a lot of this is coming from the Republicans in part because their majority in Congress is being threatened, and oftentimes when sort of the issues are against them, when the public is sort of turning against the Iraq war, then personal attacks are sort of the next best strategy. And voters do place a lot of weight on the character of the individuals that they're that they elect to Congress. So they want people who represent them, who reflect their interests and their values. And so I think that, you know, character is a valid issue in these campaigns, but we definitely have seen a lot of negative advertising this year.
So do you think it's just a function of the desperation on the part of candidates who are in tight races?
Well, I think it often is viewed that way, especially negative advertisements near the end of a campaign are usually seen as acts of desperation. Candidates normally try and go positive at the end of a campaign to sort of give voters a reason to vote for them and not necessarily just provide them with reasons to vote against the incumbent or their opponent.
All right. Let's turn our attention for a moment to some of the New York races. Let's talk about Hillary's campaign that we're all, of course, watching very closely.
Yes.
So the race is not close. What's it significant for us?
Well, I think what everyone is looking at in Hillary's re-election bid for Senate is how big of a margin or how big will her victory be? And her goal in running this re-election campaign has been to generate sort of the largest margin possible as a means of showing her strength prior to the 2008 presidential primaries. And this is what President Bush did when he was running for re-election and governor of Texas. He raised a lot of money. He ran a very successful campaign and had a very large margin of victory. And then this sort of provided wind at his back for the presidential race, particularly picking up the Republican nomination. And so I think that's what Hillary's trying to do. She spent over $30 million on this campaign, which is more than any other candidate has spent across the nation. And what's interesting about that, of course, is that she didn't face any real competition.
Right. And how much margin would be enough?
Well, I think that people are going to compare her margin of victory to that of Eliot Spitzer's. And the closer she can come to Eliot Spitzer's margin, the better that will be for her and her presidential campaign. If there's a large drop-off between Mr. Spitzer's margin of victory and her margin of victory, it will not reflect well upon her. And certainly, pundits will say that she hasn't polled as strongly or done as well in the race as she ought to have.
Great. Thank you very much, Justin. Peter King, chair of the House Homeland Security Committee and the only Republican incumbent in Long Island, hasn't faced any real challenge for 14 years. But this year, Democrats are seeing their best chance. Wei Du of Columbia Radio News reports.
Several polls show that Peter King is losing the high margin he had in six previous elections. Critics say the strategy of the Democratic challenger, Nassau County legislator Dave Mejias, is to run a referendum on President Bush's popularity.
And Peter King even says he thanks God every night that George Bush is our president. Had enough? I'm Dave Mejias.
Long Island University political science professor Stanley Klein says the Democrats in this Republican-dominated district are sticking everything on this message.
If it works, King can be defeated. If that doesn't work, King wins.
And King, the outspoken Republican, is certainly not known as a political opportunist. Despite the unpopularity of his position on a wall, he shows no sign of backing off.
Well, the King strategy basically is, I support the president. You should support the president. I am for Homeland Security, you should be for Homeland Security.
These are tough positions, but we live in very tough times.
A most recent poll shows incumbent Peter King is leading by 22%. But just a week ago, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, in a show of confidence, added Dave Mejias to its red to blue list, making a last-minute effort to help with his fundraising. I'm Wei Du, Columbia Radio News.
The Democratic Party went into Election Day needing to pick up six seats to take control of the United States Senate. Tonight, it appears they are halfway there. The Democrats have gained seats in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Rhode Island, with key races in Virginia, Missouri, and Tennessee still undecided. In another important Senate race, the polls in Montana remain open. You're listening to Battleground 2006, live coverage of the midterm elections from Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Our editorial staff includes Christine Brower, Don Duncan, Ruben Savitz, and Martina Stewart.
We had help from Ann Cooper, June Cross, Carrie Donahue, Rhoda Lipton, Marquita Poole-Eckert, Betsy West, and Bill Wheatley. Our senior editors are Kevin Lavelli and Lauren Wiener. The executive editor of Battleground 2006 from Columbia Radio News is Rebecca Kaufman.
Polls in New York and Rhode Island are about to close. More from our reporters in those states when we return. I'm Brett Elliott.
And I'm Alexa Danner.